On this episode of the Scardi podcast, we dive into the rich history of the tulip mania. Generally recognised as one of the first examples of a financial bubble, the tulip mania has been remembered as a widespread catastrophic event for the Dutch economy. However, recent research has shown that the bubble was not quite all it was claimed to be. Join the Scardi team as they challenge whether tulip mania was the bubble that never was.
The year is 1593. It's been over two decades since the first mutinies amongst the Spanish army gave confidence to various groups of Dutch rebels to stand up and fight against the once mighty Spanish government. A crucial ripple, a ripple that would soon become the wave that flushed out the remnants of the Spanish Empire. This uprising triggered what would later be known as the 80 Years' War, the tenacious Dutch revolt for independence from Spain. The war had promised many things for the newly founded Dutch Republic: Protestant Reformation, centralization, changes in taxation. But most importantly, though, the war fast-tracked the Dutch economy ahead of its European competitors. The recent injection of political independence had attracted wealthy foreign merchants and traders to port cities such as Amsterdam.
Why don't we talk about Rotterdam? Because all this is all to do with tulips, Holland, and Rotterdam, I think, is probably one of the biggest ports. But, Damien, you've been there in the last year. What's Rotterdam like? I've never even been. What's
Rotterdam,
it like?
Rotterdam, I have to be careful what I say, I suppose. I mean, it's
you've been to Rotterdam, Sam?
No, I haven't.
Where? What country is Rotterdam?
Netherlands.
Well done.
Full marks. I mean, I only saw a very small bit of Rotterdam. But flying out, you get to see quite what a massive port it is. It obviously has been there hundreds of years, and it's very industrial and sort of port-like, I suppose, as you fly out. It's nothing as like as glamorous as an Amsterdam, for example. It is there for a functional purpose only.
And is it just like container ships? Because I remember living in Hong Kong, you know, and I used to get the ferry across the harbour every day, and the ferry is just going, you know, straight past huge container ships of Maersk and Yangming Marine, One High Lines, all these kind of stuff. Is that what it's like?
And there's a lot of storage there as well. You know, there are a lot of sort of, I'm going to get my terminology wrong, silos that are there that, you know, things are offloaded to pretty fast. I think the turnaround at these places is pretty fast. And then obviously you get on the network to distribute throughout Europe. But it's certainly one of the biggest ports in Europe, I must imagine.
And did you get any sense? I mean, it's you weren't going there to look for tulips, right? you were going there to work on a specific kind of, you know, softs, commodities type thing. And you've mentioned the silos that obviously hit your psyche in that project. But was there any kind of, you know, we always think about Holland and tulips. Did you get any, looking back, any kind of flavour of that or no?
No, not at all, really. There's maritime museums, as you'd expect. No, there was no particular tulip hook that I'd noticed, but we were only there for a week or so. So
you've been to Holland, Martin?
Yes, Amsterdam. I would say I can't remember an awful lot about it. that would be totally inappropriate.
Do you remember any tulips?
I'm sure I saw a few tulips along the way, you know, and did a bit of cycling over there, which was perfect. But
a lot of people that I know who are from the Netherlands and from Holland, if they grew up there especially, quite a few of them grew up on farms where they would grow tulips. So it is, even now, it is still a massive economy for them. I don't know if that's kind of owed to not learning from mistakes or if it's just kind of carried on since then, but definitely, you know, even now, tulips are a massive thing, and they never actually, it's quite interesting because they didn't originate in the Netherlands, but even after this huge bubble, this huge kind of uptake in popularity, it's carried on, even if, you know, initially it was, they meant something different back then.
Well, it's amazing. Like, yeah, 400 years later, you the pitch postcard of the windmill with the tulip fields and the people on the bikes. You know, that's why I felt sure Martin will have ridden past one.
Maybe.
With the economy now being led by powerful urban oligarchies, and with the Spaniard armies on the run, what then did the Dutch have to fear? Well, my dear listeners, unbeknownst to the thriving Dutch merchants, along the spice trade routes to the east, the seeds of their destruction were being sown. The seeds of the deadly tulip.
Yeah, so to start off, what I would say is I've wanted to do the Tulip Story as a podcast for the longest time, because it's something that's kind of been ingrained in my psyche. I think I heard about tulips before I even came to work in the financial markets. Sam, yeah. Did you know about tulips before?
Well, I knew about the flower tulips, but I didn't really know backstory about the whole... What is it?
Bubble.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Bubble. I got told that was the first I think I heard about the tulip bubble being like a big thing, but I only really knew it as, you know, tulip prices were just ridiculously high, and that was the first kind of bubble that I seem to remember learning.
I think it's easier to explain, I suppose, than the South Sea bubble, which is the other sort of famous one back in history, because actually I think you could go, well, you know, I understand a tulip's a tangible thing, and it seems bonkers that you would pay more than a quid for what, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So for it to become, it's sort of, yeah, I think I certainly heard of it, you know, way back. I mean, possibly pre-starting in the city. But
yeah, so. I think likewise, it's always been one of the most famous examples of, a bubble and subsequent crash. And I think when new assets come onto the scene, like cryptocurrencies, and there's a lot of speculation, and people watching that particular market at the moment, I think this is kind of story that resurfaces time and again. It's people refer back to it a lot, and I know it has been researched. And
well, it's such a powerful, potent story, isn't it? Because I think for anyone who hears it, it's nuts. I mean, it's still nuts kind of thinking about it now, that something that's so plainly ridiculous, a tulip bulb, could end up transacting, well, anecdotally, for more than a house. That's the way it was told to me, that the speculation just got so rampant that, people, everyone was involved, all of Dutch society, doesn't matter what they were. And you kind of think of back to kind of COVID, yeah, and the parallels where everyone had a bit of cash because people sort of weren't going out or whatever and started punting around in cryptocurrency. And it's the same kindest, and that's when I told you about it, Coleman, because you know talking about kind of bubbles, I don't think prior to that, maybe you had learned about it prior to that, I don't know, or was it me telling you about it?
Well, interestingly, I only really heard about or learned about the upside of the bubble and never really got told or even thought to think about the kind of the bursting of the bubble and the effect that had on the economy. I just sort of, it had always just been a thing that, you know, tulips were going through these ridiculously high prices, and how that kind of climaxed and subsided never really actually came up even until I did research for this podcast.
And Martin, how did you come across it? Can you recall? Who told you, when you were told,
Cannot really recall the first time I heard about it. It's just apart from being a classic example of an asset price bubble and collapse, but you definitely hear more about it with market, the way the markets have been swinging and the volatility in the markets recently. People refer to bubbles of years gone by, and that's obviously a very famous one.
And it's the fact that it keeps getting referred back to.
Yeah, it's your go-to bubble.
Your go-to bubble, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So for me, it was my dad, I think, told me about the tulip bubble, you know, and you know, father to son, I've told Coleman about it. So it's a generational story.
Indeed. In 1593, the tulip made its very first appearance to the Dutch market. It was unlike any flower native to Europe, an exotic and neat flower. a flower that would soon become a symbol of luxury and upper-class stature for the Dutch. So much so that it quickly became common knowledge that any man of fortune who lacked a collection of tulips was deemed to have very poor taste indeed. By the early 1600s, the Dutch obsession for tulips had progressed to the next stage. Professional cultivators began to develop techniques in order to grow these flowers locally, refining their methods for faster growth. Now, when a tulip is grown from a seed, it can take 7 to 12 years for it to actually flower. As you can imagine, Dutch traders were anxious to grow them a lot faster than this, to hopefully spin off a huge profit. It was swiftly discovered, however, that tulips planted from a bulb could flower the very next year, making for a much faster business model.
Out of this market, you know, the delivery dynamic and the fact that you've only got these things flowering in a month, I believe, between April and May, you've got delivery considerations. You know, we've talked about the fact that before they worked out that it came from a seed and you could use a bulb, you know, you had 12 years waiting for something to arrive or to be able to flower, which causes kind of huge uncertainty over whether, you know, 12 years out, is that thing actually going to be there, or is it going to die in the meantime, or have disease or whatever. So it does seem to me that there are, you know, a lot of innovations around, one, the financing of this industry, but also the trading of this stuff, right? There was a lot of futures trading, wasn't there?
Some of the original futures were traded around this, and I think they designed contracts because it could only be, in inverted commas, delivered in a very short window, but people wanted to trade them all year round. So therefore, the futures were a way to trade that, and you could therefore not ever take delivery because you buy the future and sell it on hopefully at a higher price to somebody else, and then it, you know, it's not your problem, God, as it were.
And
it turns out that it's spoiled.
And I think in reading about this, we did read about the fact that there was an occasion where they had to start letting people have kind of get out clauses for a fixed fee, where they could close off futures contracts rather than honour them. And that brings a little bit of optionality in, right?
Yeah, yes.
A bit of premium.
Yeah, I think that's what, I mean, what we've read so far seems to suggest that actually there was the sort of beginnings of an option market formed around this because they were in such high demand. So it was another interesting development that we saw from the Dutch.
And, well, I think, you know, this is all about the financing of trade, and trade finance is definitely something that I think, you know, we've experienced that the Dutch are pretty strong with. I mean, Martin, Damien, myself, we worked for the Dutch, worked for ING.
Yeah.
They're pretty good at trade finance. If anyone wants to know more about the history of trade finance, we had a wonderful podcast with Dominic Broom, who used to be with ABN AMRO, another Dutch house. In the early part of his career, who gives a really good overall picture of trade finance and puts it into a historical perspective. So I'd recommend anyone looking, for more information on that to have a look back at that podcast. And we can certainly make sure the link is available for that. I think we should do for people who want to kind of know more about that. So that's something people can take away from this podcast.
Alongside the tulips themselves, the rapidly flowering bulbs became a prized possession for any earnest merchant. To the untrained eye, or in fact anyone who was unaware of the recent tulip craze, the bulb bore an astonishingly similar resemblance to that of a white onion. People would often find themselves in an awkward or expensive mix-up if they happened to have a great partiality for white onions. Blainville's Travels tells of a famous incident in which a sailor unknowingly eats the value of 12 months of food for him and his crew in a single sitting. The story tells of a wealthy merchant who dabbled in the industry of trading rare tulips among other prized luxury goods. On one day in particular, he received an especially valuable consignment of goods from the Levant. The news of its arrival was brought to him by a sailor who was responsible for delivering the goods to the merchant. Ecstatic with the good news, and aware of the lengthy efforts the sailor must have undergone to deliver his consignment in one piece, The merchant rewarded the sailor by making him a fine red herring for his breakfast. Now, whilst the sailor waited in the merchant's shop for his tasty breakfast, he noticed a bulb very much like an onion lying on the countertop. The sailor was puzzled. A common item such as this surely had no place among fine silks and delicate trinkets. Without giving it a second thought, he slipped the bulb into his pocket, knowing it would be a perfect complement to his breakfast.
So I think what I'm minded about when I think about this, I remember when I was out in Asia reading about truffles, and in one particular situation, you know, a truffle went for a crazy price and then just rotted, which is a bit, it's not the same as a sailor eating it, but I mean, it is kind of a tragedy when you, because Sam, I got you to look at this, didn't I? How much did this go for?
Well, I had a brief look at it, and I saw that it went for £28,000 sterling, which then rotted in the fridge at the restaurant.
That's criminal, man. Can you imagine it? Mind you, I bet they got some good advertising.
I was about to say, we got a few cards.
Try and get on the table there.
Yeah. And that is absolutely, I mean, it doesn't even bear thinking about. But that's, you know, that's the stuff with perishable stuff. But I think actually in the context of stuff, it's not even, you know, I suppose £28,000 or whatever it was back in 2004.
I think you're right. I think, the prices of truffles aren't coming down anytime soon. I think a couple of years back, I remember one going for about $118,000. I think in an auction, maybe in Italy. But, they're not coming down anytime soon, it would appear.
I mean, that is absolutely frightening, isn't it? But, hey, you know, if that's what people need to pay for things, and that's the market price. You're listening to the Scardi podcast. Scardi are the financial experts. Our deep understanding of complex financial products and front office expertise give us the ability to ask the right questions for you and solve the problems other subject matter experts cannot see at speed. Whether we've worked as traders or in operations, everyone you'll speak to at Scardi has frontline knowledge and a deep understanding of financial products. We share our practical financial knowledge, analysis, focus, and clear thinking, and we communicate with clarity. We're proudly multilingual. We take great care to make our findings accessible so you feel confident, you understand what's happening, when, and why. Scardi, the financial experts.
The sailor collected his breakfast and made off to the quay to eat it along with his newly acquired bulb. Not long after he left, the merchant noticed his prized Semper Augustus bulb, worth over 3,000 florins, had gone missing. Understandably, he took to the streets in haste, with a mob of workers and family members to chase down the sailor. They searched the docks high and low for the sailor, until at last they found him sitting on a coil of old ship rope. But alas, it was too late. The sailor had already licked his plate clean and polished off the last morsel of his bulb. Needless to say, the sailor would become forever suspicious of any potentially priceless onions. Thankfully, such kerfuffles became rarer and rarer as the popularity and notoriety of the tulip grew ever larger. Everyone from powerful oligarchs to chimney sweeps in the streets were racing to get their hangs on a single tulip. The game had turned from a competition of who could own the most into a competition of who could flip them the most for the highest profit margins.
The Dutch auction, I think, is something that, you know, again, that's in my psyche, and please, I hope no one sits here and tells me, Nick, then actually the Dutch auction doesn't exist, everything you thought about the Dutch auction was wrong. But what is a Dutch auction, Damien?
It does exist, you'll be glad to hear, and I think was started around that sort of time period, and it's an auction in reverse, bizarrely. So rather than a classical auction, which will start at a low price and go up until you find your final buyer who then deals. A Dutch auction, and I think it's still used in flower markets today, is you set a very high price to start with, and then you have a specific time period by which the price will drop that everyone knows who is participant in the auction. And it will keep on dropping until someone says mine, and you will deal at that price. And the useful thing, I mean, there are arguments that I've had a quick look online to see, is it more efficient to be a sort of standard auction or a Dutch? And I think over time they will tend to the right price. But the useful thing about a Dutch auction is that you know it will have a finite time period. So in a normal auction, you know, you could be bidding for an hour and then suddenly...
Well, you get a couple of competitive bidders, exactly, so you can go on and on.
Whereas a flower market, and sorry, flour is obviously a perishable product, time is of the essence. So you start at a high price, hopefully such a high price that, you know, no one will deal, and then it will tick down, and then someone will deal, and then bosh, then you'll move on. So there's one auction gone,
and it's gone,
and
it's
you
gone.
Go, we're gone.
There's, yeah, there's another glaringly obvious thing there, Martin, which is about manipulation, right? Because I'm just listening to that and thinking about a normal auction where there is potential for manipulation because you just keep outbidding the other party.
Sure, yeah.
And obviously there's a game of kind of cat and mouse in there, but it's not, you know, in the case where a price is dropping and you're in and you're done,
yeah,
you'd think that there's less scope for manipulation, or is my perception
especially
wrong?
Especially if you don't see the other bids, for example, you know, you're putting in a bid that you're prepared to pay.
As in a sealed bid, you mean, rather than a sort of...
Yeah, and I think... you know, in the case of the U.S. Treasury, if they're using a Dutch auction process, you know, you'll be one of a group of primary dealers, for example, putting in your bids, and then you know the price will come down to a level where they will deal. And mine is yours. You don't, and so you get a certainty.
Yeah, I think in the U.S. Treasury auction, obviously there's more than one participant, and more than one person can, inverted commas, win. But you all deal at the same price.
Yeah,
it's not
exactly,
like, so if you say, well, I'm happy to deal and I'm happy to pay up, or I'm not happy to take a lower yield, you don't sort of win and beat everybody else. You all deal at that one price.
Right.
But yes, I think you're right. I hadn't really thought about that point you were making, Nick, about manipulation. I think
I just think it could cut down on it. I'm sure it'd be interesting for people to comment afterwards about how to game a Dutch auction. That could be a really interesting thread after this podcast. And we would welcome those kind of conversations, because at the end of the day, you know, this podcast is meant for people in the financial markets, but also for the control functions and for helping them understand and weed out stuff and also expand their knowledge. I'd love to have a conversation about how, you know, a Dutch auction could be manipulated. But to me, just thinking about it now, it seems one obvious advantage in a Dutch auction, amongst all the other advantages that it has. I mean, I like that that skew, i.e. you know with a Dutch auction that it can only go to zero. Whereas in a normal auction, the sky's the limit. The price can keep going and going and going. And then, of course, that adds into the time effect. Whereas, of course, it's going to be much more reduced time, because where can you go? You can only go to zero. I hope this isn't like some sort of Spinal Tap moment. You can go to 11. but yeah, it's sort of that's kind of interesting to me in all of this.
The money-making opportunity began to drive tulip prices to ludicrous heights. New companies were established purely with the intention to buy and sell tulips. Charity auctions were set up, financed by the highest in Dutch society, hosted specifically to break single item sale records. By 1637, a single bulb was worth as much as 5,500 florins, an amount that would have afforded a mansion on the finest canal in Amsterdam. The bubble was at its peak.
What I think really surprised me, and this shows you how much I know about the tulip story, I totally wanted us to go into this podcast to just discuss bubbles, and it part of a series of bubbles, because I had actually no idea what Coleman was going to research and discover, which is that actually it was, or it has been since proved that this was the bubble that never was. Mm. Is that the case? Or not really the bubble? There was a bubble, right? But it wasn't the extent. So. What did you find out?
Well, there was definitely a bubble in terms of speculation and tulip prices going through the roof. Whether it actually reverberated through the economy and, you know, caused this kind of Armageddon of people being bankrupt and you know, whatnot, as it was told, as kind of the story goes, that's actually more of a myth now, because recently that the recently well the person who sort of started off that kind of exaggeration was a guy called Charles Mackay, who's a Scottish poet around writing around about the 1800s, and he did he wrote on a few bubbles in his book, the Delusions of Crowds and whatnot, whatever it is. But he said basically he was painting this picture that everyone from chimney sweeps to the kind of rich, powerful, the rich and most powerful in Dutch society were trading these tulips to try and get a profit. Just like some kind of, like crypto today, that anyone can buy it. Doesn't matter how much you have of it, how rich you are, or even, you know, things like sneakers, for example. You get all sorts of people trying to buy these kind of dead stock, low in quantity, high in demand, to try and resell them for a massive profit. And so he was painting this kind of picture that everyone was involved. And then it wasn't until recently, about 2007, 2008, Anne Goldgar came along and basically looked into it, looked into all the records and the actual nitty-gritty of you know, financial transactions, all these kind of things, and discovered that actually it didn't have that bad effect. A lot of people were fine after it, and it only actually affected a small part of Dutch society, which were the kind of the richest, the people at the top who were, I mean, it makes sense, because they would be the only ones who would actually be able to afford these kind of ridiculous prices of tulips. The only people who would be invited to such auctions where they would be selling these tulips and take part in them.
So Anne Goldgar, what was her interest in this, other than disproving this guy?
Well, so when I was reading up on it, she basically didn't know that it was actually going to, she was going to kind of disprove it at all. She just wanted to have another look at it. And basically in her research kind of discovered, you know, this guy who'd been writing, Charles Mackay, was actually, he was almost a fraud. I think, was it Martin, you were saying that someone else around the time
discovered?
Yeah,
I think Earl Thompson, again, agrees with the theory that it didn't really have a massive effect on the overall Dutch economy. It was certainly a bubble, and I think, you know, when a lot of noise is being generated, people will jump on board and say, okay, look, these things are going through the roof, we have to get involved ourselves, much like, as you say, crypto now.
FOMO.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think one of the conclusions that were drawn, I think, in the report said, you know, basically with the time lag, you know, from bulb to flower, there was going to be a mismatch between supply and demand, where interest increased in the tulips, and eventually supply caught up with demand, which obviously helped with the prices coming back down to earth in a hurry. But I think the conclusions from the reports that I've seen suggest that, yes, you know, it affected a few people, and quite a few people lost a lot of money, but it wasn't across the whole Dutch population or economy. And I suppose when you look back at crypto, with the crypto winter that we're in currently, yes, you know, the headlines, or you can't avoid the headlines everywhere, but then the percentage of the population that is involved and have huge losses could be small, you know.
Well, yeah, I think it would be, and I suppose a bit like the dot-com bubble to a degree. I mean, you might say that reverberated more, but I suppose how you define a bubble is, does it have to reach a lot of people to be still a bubble? I mean, obviously not. I mean, a bubble is just something going up in price way beyond its
fundamentals and rational.
But I'm surprised to learn that the tulip bubble was not.
It sounds from what Martin's described as much more of a kind of a volatile price with a lot of range due to supply and demand, as opposed to this kind of, you know, really massively inflated boom bust that we've all kind of heard about. And I love the idea that Anne Goldgar entered into this without a kind of preconception, but wanted to test. It's kind of like audit testing, do you know what I mean? Like you're trying to figure out, when you encounter some kind of thing that you want to, you know, some inquiry that you're going to do in an audit, for example,
yeah.
or, you know, you can talk about investigations, where she's actually gone away and done some pretty smart thinking about where to go for, you know, to test this historical situation, because of course she's looking at this, as was your guy Thompson, in the mid-2000s. This is something that occurred back in the 1600s, right, if I'm correct. Is that right, Coleman?
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, it actually raised an interesting point in that the time that Goldgar was writing about it and Earl Thompson was right in the kind of mix of the GFC, but then also they probably...
Well, they published in the GFC, but really it's pre, so they're in the bubble, the credit bubble.
Exactly. And you had the dot-com bubble, and then the time that Charles Mackay was writing was right is in the 1800s, around about when the South Sea bubble would have happened. And so probably his writings were probably massively influenced by that bubble. And probably Goldgar and Earl Thompson, I would imagine, had been influenced by them as well. But I think the kind of the difference in the two might have something to say about, you know, the approach that they both had, the kind of skepticism that Goldgar and Thompson had, but that Mackay didn't. Mackay was almost...
Well, maybe he just was looking for a story to suit a narrative, as it were, rather than... And for whatever reason throughout history, people have latched onto it and run with it and gone, well, obviously that must be true. And it's taken another... My math isn't good enough.
A few more hundred years. And a fresh pair of eyes.
A fresh pair of eyes.
But also he's a poet, not an economist or, you know, financial expert by trade. He might have been kind of seeing all this terminology about bubbles and stuff and assumed quite a lot of knowledge and assumed a lot of commonalities between that and the tulip mania, which maybe, you know, once it kind of took a bit more deep dive, you know.
But also it kind of brings out the point that it's also the perception at the time. So he may not have been in a position where he could have tested, bizarrely, even though he was closer in time. Whereas it seems to me that Golgo, who did some really smart stuff, right? I mean, she went away and looked at records of the time, you know, in the libraries and found or tried to find evidence of economic stress and bankruptcies and delinquencies, and couldn't find that. But I kind of wonder whether it was almost easier for her doing that work then.
So, well, yes, marked more recently, as in he's, I assume, stuck in Scotland.
Yeah.
To actually get hold of Dutch records, well, you've got to kind of, you know, get over there to have a look. It's not like you can look online or go to the, I mean, you could get to the archives, I should think. I mean, it sort of goes to show, I suppose, record keeping at the end of the day is key in all of this. We all sort of laugh thinking about that with all this stuff going on with WhatsApp, etc. at the moment. But actually, you know, once you've got records of something that's gone on, you can then go back to interrogate them, to actually look at what's gone on, rather than going, well, he said this, so therefore it must be true, let's move along, please. You know, it's that sort of, I don't know, I think it brings up that as a point.
I think you're absolutely, absolutely right.
You've been listening to the Scardy Podcast, written and produced by me, Colman Corrie. Join with me in discussion today with Nicholas Corrie, Damien Taylor, Martin Anthony and Sam Almassi. If you want to hear more episodes on the Scardy Podcast, go check out our website or simply search the Scardy Podcast on any streaming platform.